Hello and welcome to the Smart Beauty Podcast. I'm your host, Viola Levy, beauty journalist and founder of copy-led branding agency, Smart Beauty Creative. We're here to create your brand voice and craft the story behind it. Today, we're joined by Francesca Cheruo, founder of Filthy Brands, a company shaking up the fragrance distribution landscape. Francesca's journey began at Eccentric Molecules, where she witnessed firsthand how a niche fragrance brand could disrupt the industry and redefine the way people buy perfume. She realized her passion lay in helping brands grow from obscurity to global recognition. With Filthy Brands, Francesca is on a mission to give independent fragrance houses the retail presence they deserve, competing with industry giants while maintaining a strong brand identity. We'll be diving into how the fragrance industry has evolved, why consumers are buying differently today, and the strategy behind getting niche brands onto the shelves of top retailers like Selfridges, Liberty, and Sephora. Hope you enjoy our chat. Lovely to speak to you, Francesca. Great to hear a bit more about your journey into the world of fragrance distribution. And what was the inspiration behind Filthy Brands?
Oh, hello, Violet. I started my journey in fragrance at Eccentric Molecule. Got a taste for what it was like to see and be a part of a business go from nothing and the innovation behind that fragrance of Molecule 01 and seeing it grow. And then seeing how the fragrance industry shifted from the commercial land of fragrance, you know, like Britney Spears and all the big, fashion houses, you know, Chanel, Yves Saint Laurent, all doing fragrances. And then I really feel like Eccentric Molecules are at the forefront of the beginning of niche fragrance.
Definitely.
And the change in the way that people bought fragrance as well.
Hmm.
I started off as literally like the assistant to one of the founders.
What an amazing brand to kind of kick off with.
I really was like, you know, fetching coffee and taking notes in meetings, and you know, I didn't walk in and I was, you know, head of sales or anything like that. I mean, I really did start at the bottom. But I think in a way, almost starting at the bottom, you're then, you know, you're in every single meeting, you're there,
yeah,
you know, from the buyers from the age of 21, you're in there with, you know, Harvey Nichols, you're there with Cult Beauty, you're there with every single distributor, you're learning every single day, just by listening and taking notes. I was there for almost 9 years, working with the team through the different stages of success, and seeing it grow. And then left, and then I went over to a small UK fragrance house called Laboratory Perfumes, and I worked there for 3 years. And I realized after sort of this amount of time that I really enjoyed working with brands in their infancy. I think that there's something so magical seeing a no one become a someone.
Yeah, seeing it all come together and
it's alive. It's such a beautiful thing, you know. It's so you feel like such a sense of pride when you see it in like in Liberty's window or launching in Selfridges, or you know. And I think for me, Filthy really came from this. Like, wait, hold on a second. You can see all the big brands, Estee Lauder and, you know, L'Oreal, Coty, all their brands taking up all the shelf space. And I think there was a part of me which was like, oh, it'd be so fun if I could just like knock a couple of them off the shelf.
Yeah.
Like, not in a bad way, but just like, because there's a bit of competition in me. And just
mix things up a bit. No,
yeah,
I
just like mix it up a bit and see if you can actually actually do it. And it's great to see it when it works, you know, and not just brands that are being fueled by cash, because I do think that the consumer is now, they're buying into a brand, but they're also buying very differently than they did 20, 30 years ago.
How so? What do you think they're kind of is grabbing their attention nowadays as opposed to back then?
I think the education in fragrance has been huge. I think consumers are buying now by notes. This idea, that people love sandalwood. I mean, it started with probably the Labo 33. I think that started, the trend of like, oh, actually, someone walking into Liberty's and going, I love a sandalwood fragrance, show me what you've got, rather than going, I love Britney Spears, therefore I want Britney Spears' fragrance. Or, I mean, that's quite
Well,
a
I'm going on a date tonight.
horrible.
What should I wear? Kind of thing.
Yeah, exactly.
Really, yeah, stabbing in the dark.
Yeah, or my grandma wears this, therefore I need to wear this as well. The generational fragrance and the way that it reminds you of a memory. I think people now are buying fragrance, wanting to create their own stamp
Yeah.
in their own world.
I mean, it's probably the most personal product you can buy for yourself, isn't it? In the way it kind of mingles with your own scent and becomes, a part of you in a way. I mean, do you think that stories play a strong role when it comes to, the emotional decision behind choosing a perfume?
Yes, I mean, I think now people don't really have signature scents anymore.
No, thank God.
Every
I'm really anti that. It's like wearing the same outfit every day. I mean,
day. I
yeah.
mean, I'm a sucker for wearing the same outfit to work every day just because I don't know, it's so much easier. I like a school uniform.
Oh, same. Oh my gosh, yeah. I have like a winter uniform of like jeans and a variety of black polo neck tops. But
Fragrance
in an
does
ideal
feel a lot
world,
easier to
it
change.
makes life easier. But
Yeah.
I just feel like in an ideal world, if I had like limitless budget and a stylist, I would go to town.
Yeah, of course. If someone told me what to wear every morning, it would feel a lot more comfortable.
Yeah.
I guess with fragrance, it's there's yeah, I think people aren't just buying into one fragrance anymore. People are buying multiple fragrances for their mood. You could go out on a Friday night and want to smell Oudi and like a Russian princess. But then on a Monday to work, you want something very understated. You don't really want to overpower the office with a scent. I do think it changes the social situations you're in or how you want to feel in that moment.
Yeah, it's like your makeup, you kind of switch it up depending on the
Yeah.
occasion, what's appropriate. I heard a funny fact that in Japan, certain sushi restaurants have actually banned perfume because it interferes with the flavors. So I think you have to be kind of discerning about what you wear and when to wear it.
I mean, definitely. I mean, like you, it's sort of if you're in the kitchen cooking, I don't know, a roast or a steak, you're not going to have a scented candle burning in the corner because
Yeah.
the mixture of that is going to be totally, I mean, it's going to be a very weird mix of, sandalwood and the smell of steak. But yeah, I do think that there's definitely a way that the consumer's now buying, which makes it more exciting for younger brands to get a foot in the door.
And so where do you come in where that's concerned?
Yeah, I
Because,
get them in the door, hopefully.
yeah,
That's the
that's
plan.
basically in a nutshell, your role as a distributor is getting brands in the door.
Yeah, so I mean, I'm not, so I guess the term of a distributor would be someone, a company that buys stock, and then you then sell that stock to retailers. What I actually do at Filthy Brands, or what we do at Filthy Brands, is we are, would say, more of a sales partner. So we help navigate the world of retail. So we don't do anything with D2C, nothing with your own, nothing with your own website or your social media sales, but we navigate the complexities of the retail landscape. So that means in the UK, we would work directly with the stores, Selfridges, Harvey Nichols, Liberty's, Sephora, Boots, everyone, that you can think of, we work with directly, Cult Beauty. And then on a global scale, because it's really important to have the same brand narrative globally through retail to make sure that, if you're in Liberty in London,
Yeah, you don't want to be in Target in the US or something.
exactly, like it makes absolutely no sense. So you need someone who has control of the overriding picture of your retail strategy.
Yeah.
And so with different territories, we would make sure that we are negotiating contracts with correct distributors or retailers that we believe, and not just believe, that we have discussed internally with our clients, that make sure that there is fluidity across the, or you know, the brand story is aligned around the world. So there's not huge disparity between each country.
So you don't just focus on the UK retailers, but you do global retailers as well.
Yeah, exactly. So we actually grow, you know, I one brand I worked with, I think he was actually my second brand that I ever started working with, a brand called Fugazi Fragrances. We started working together during lockdown, and I mean, the first year was really tough. Not only was it lockdown, it was difficult to get it into retail.
Can't even imagine how much of an uphill struggle that was during that time when no one was buying anything.
Pretty and you know, 4.5 years later, as a team, and with his willingness as well, and together, you know, I mean, I think he's now in 48 different countries and over 800 retailers.
It's incredible.
And it's a real joint venture, you know. It's, you know, it has to be a team effort. It's not just one person who makes it happen. It's just the founder and Filthy that make it happen. It's also the distributors that we work with that are going to take a chance on a new brand. It's the retailers. I remember Cult Beauty being the first retailer in the UK to take a chance on Fugazi. And that was huge in the UK for Cult Beauty. You know, a retailer that sees, I don't know, 30 brands a day, you have to make it super easy for them to say yes to it.
For sure.
If you make it complicated, then there's another brand just behind you that's going to take your place.
So making it easy in terms of what sort of describing, the telling the story about the brand, or are there any other kind of how do you, how do you kind of make it so that retailers automatically want to take the brand on board?
I think there are a number of different factors. The first one is the relationship that you have with the buyer, which is obviously how Filthy comes into this. A lot of the buyers I've known for a really long time, and the industry's so small that they all hop around the same places in the UK. You know, they're like, you get the email, like, I've just left so and so, and then 2 weeks later they pop up at another retailer.
Like
And then
whack-a-mole.
like, oh, okay, great. I think there's that, and then this that opens the door, but it doesn't necessarily get the brand placed with that retailer. It doesn't get you listed. The thing that will get you listed is making your brand story incredibly clear to the point. There's no uphill battle with like why you've created it. Just keep it super simple. If you had 20 seconds to explain your brand to anyone, what would it be? And then that's all you need to say. You know, it's these people trying to create new ways of telling us. The story needs to be super simple. Your terms and conditions have to be super simple. And just make that process really easy for a buyer to go, yes.
So, do you think it's your kind of relationships that set you apart from other distributors, or are there any other kind of? Because I know you're sort of the fact that you're fragrance specific, obviously, is another kind of element. But is there any other ways that you guys kind of differentiate yourselves?
Yeah, I think our portfolio brands, the brands that we have, they all have their own lane, so there's no competition between them. Everyone, we actually create families within our portfolio. So for example, like August and Pierce, they're a beautiful scented candle business. I would pair them with a fragrance brand like 2787. You know, they go very nicely together. And then you have brands like I don't know, like Golf Le Fleur by Tyler the Creator, that obviously he's an incredibly successful music artist, but Golf Le Fleur stands on its own.
Yeah.
You think, okay, so where would I put you in the brand list? Think about it. It's interesting because actually you Golf Le Fleur and Fugazi would probably sit very nicely together in the same stores. And so there's no overriding competition because they all have something slightly different to them, which makes them have their own world within our filthy family.
For sure. And I imagine when you approach, so something a store like Cult Beauty, which is online only, that's a
Yeah.
completely different sell, I imagine, because obviously there's no counter space, there's no kind of testers that customers can go and sample. So what are those retailers kind of looking for in a fragrance that they can effectively sell online without any kind of samples for the customer to try?
Aesthetics, what the bottle looks like, what the packaging looks like, and then also the sampling is huge for online retailers. You have to be prepared to give away a lot of 2 mil samples.
Yeah, not great for the environment though, I
It's
imagine.
not great for the environment. I would say that it is the only way to sell fragrance online is to be, yeah, I mean, the 2 mil samples is really the way to do it, or taking part in their beauty boxes,
Yeah.
initiatives like that, gift with purchase, all of these things. You have to really think outside of the box. And unfortunately, actually, to be honest, Cult Beauty is one of the best, I think, in terms of like unlocking free marketing.
Yeah.
And I think that's where Filthy Brands comes in, is we know which stores to work with for young brands, where you can unlock a lot more free marketing over other stores, which require quite a hefty cash investment.
I was going to say, because I imagine a lot of people, they think, well, once I'm in Space NK or once I'm in Liberty, then that's it, happily ever
That's just
after,
the
like roll
beginning.
credits. And actually, like, I've sort of, over the years realized that, your brand still has to work its ass off once it's on that to stay on those shelves. And I guess from your perspective, you have to come to them with like a plan of action. Like once we get in, this is what we're going to do, this is how we're going to market it, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, you have to also keep up with the demands from the retailer. So you can go in with a collection of six fragrances. It's really difficult. I really struggle with it because we live in a world where now where there is so much like instant gratification.
Yeah.
So social media, you can buy something within like 2 minutes. TikTok, it's like a new, it's almost like QVC. You just go on it and
Yeah.
like
But there is an incredible amount of shit on social media. I've bought stuff that has kind of arrived, and I'm like, oh my gosh, what did I spend all this money? So.
no, of course. As for, what was I saying this? I was saying that, yeah, so with retail, it's a lot slower.
Yeah, but you've got that trust embedded within that retailer, I guess.
Exactly. And actually, the trust that you, the brand trust that you get from, saying that you're retailed in Liberty, or I don't know, for a brand that's sold in Sephora or Cult Beauty,
Yeah.
you get that sort of like tick of approval that one of the big guys has said yes to you. I think one of the biggest struggles brands have is because we all live in this world of like very fast-paced buying.
Yeah.
This consumerism is just at the end, like top of our fingertips. You can, like you say, you can buy all this crap on social media and it's delivered tomorrow. Retail is actually a little bit slower, and
Sure.
you have to invest in it. But the long game is obviously, it could be hugely financially beneficial to you, but it is a long game. And if you don't, unfortunately, if you don't have the money to invest in retail, sort of the bricks and mortar side of wholesale, then yeah, it can be tricky because it does take time to build your presence in Liberty, for example, or Selfridges.
Yeah, for sure. What do you think brands should consider then, on that note, when it comes to working with a distributor or just going it alone and saying, well, we'll just try and sell on TikTok for now and see how we do. And then once we kind of get more established, then we can try and venture, elsewhere.
It's difficult because I also I understand. I mean, I work with founders every single day. The need for cash is so important in this business. People have invested hundreds of thousands of pounds into a brand and they need to see it come back quite quickly to make it viable. If you can start small and pace yourself, I think you're better off in the long run. I think if you can be strategic with the stores that you're selling in and very specific with your distribution, I think you'll have a brand that will last a lot longer. The only concern I have for brands that are on TikTok is there's like such a huge like spike very quickly. And you wonder like how you can thrive off of that spike on social media before it people move on to the next big thing. I mean, even Sephora have like a whole stand, which is like the next best thing on social media, in store. And that changes every 6 weeks. So, you wonder if you are going to invest in your social media. I totally understand it, but I would prefer a brand work methodically and strategically on their wholesale strategy before throwing themselves into a world of instant gratification like TikTok that lasts 6 or 7 weeks.
Definitely. And then you're only focusing on one particular demographic with TikTok, whereas, there are sort of like different, different generations that prefer to shop in, bricks and mortar stores, for example. So it's kind of like you're cutting off a whole kind of chunk of your market by just focusing, I guess, on one channel.
I mean, the only other thing as well to remember is like if you're selling on, if you're selling your D2C or your TikTok, I actually don't know how much percentage they take. But from a wholesale perspective, obviously you're baking the margins they take are more than what you would be selling your D2C at, which obviously is also a huge barrier for brands who can't afford to lower their wholesale price to make it fit with retail.
Yeah, so it's more about kind of raising brand awareness, would you say, getting into a retailer as opposed to
If
making
you can,
hard
yeah.
cash?
I guess we try and balance it.
Yeah.
You balance it with I don't know, like a shop like Credo in the US, which is a beautiful store. They have so many locations. And then you can balance that with, for example, like a huge social media presence in a different territory that doesn't really matter if they see it or they don't see it. And you choose which territory to do that in. So if you're going to be huge on social media in the UK, then maybe actually our strategy would be to make you huge through wholesale in the US. So that you've get that balance and then you change it. So then in Europe, maybe we just do independent stores to get the cool kids, the East London kids involved. And then there's just that you have to always be balancing.
Yeah, so it's not a case of like you work with a brand, once you get them in to, I don't know, Harrods, then that's it. It's an ongoing relationship where you're constantly having to change and switch up kind of your strategy as it comes to, when it comes to like where they're stocked and how they're stocked.
Massively, it's also, the pace of trends changing is so quick now. And you have to be so careful with making sure that you're either if you're a brand and you're making a really big splash as a launch, with great big over-the-top packaging, maybe in sort of 4 years' time, once everybody kind of knows who you are, maybe dial it back a bit. So that there's longevity to the brand, so that you won't be cut out by trends changing. I mean, you see it all the time, brands all going for the Byredo packaging now.
Oh,
Everybody's
for
excited
sure.
about packaging. They're so scared to get left behind with the trends changing.
That's a problem, I guess, because then I think brands can get complacent. If they go viral, then they kind of rest on their laurels and just think, well, that's it. But actually, like you say, it's about longevity. It's not just about being a flash in the pan overnight success and then.
But also, maybe people do want that. You know, there is also that, which is like maybe someone just wants to become an overnight success, make X amount of money, be happy with that, and then call it quits and do something else. That's also fine. It's just not the business that I'm in. I'm
Yeah.
really trying to create long-standing, going to go up against Estée Lauder, L'Oreal, and Coty forever.
Yeah, so imagine when you kind of consider whether to take a brand on, that's kind of at the front of your mind is whether they're in it for the long haul or whether they just want to make a quick buck.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of you know, I remember when I first started Filthy, I was very, very flexible. I was like, oh, I'll do anything, you know, because you're all by
Yeah.
yourself.
Yeah.
You know, you prove your worth.
That's the problem, isn't it? When you're starting out, it's
Yeah.
yeah, you hum it, I'll strum it kind of
Yeah,
thing.
and now it's now my interview process is a lot tougher. You know, the first question will always be, what are your dream stores? And it is, it's so funny when people are like, oh, I want to be in, you know, this tiny little independent store. And I'm like, that's great, but you'll make 800 quid from
Yeah.
that. They'll place an order and then that'll be it. And then the other thing is just making sure that we align.
Yeah.
Because
Yeah,
actually, if
you
their
know.
strategy is just to do, you know, D2C and social media, then I'm not the right partner for you.
No. No, I imagine you need to be like on a similar wavelength and kind of get along because I imagine you're working so closely together under really high pressured conditions. So I imagine like the relationship has to be kind of super strong from the beginning in order to, you know, that there's no miscommunication or cross wires.
Yeah, I mean, you know, the team and I have WhatsApp groups with every single one of our brands.
Yeah.
That's like every day that like WhatsApps and messages and emails, and you know, we're constantly in touch with everyone. And I think maybe that is what makes us different, is that we're available all the time.
Yeah.
Because I think part of Filthy was really about instilling in the brand's mind that we are an extension of their team. You know, but that is how they should see us. You know, the difference is we're all in different offices, but actually we are an extension of their team.
Yeah, you're an integral part of it, you know, being a success and like you say, knocking Chanel off the shelves.
Yeah, but also we're the first, if in a retail world, we're the first point of contact
Yeah.
brand. So we have to represent that brand as
You're
if
their
it,
ambassadors in that sense.
yeah. As if it were our own brand. We have to make sure that we know everything, you know, RRPs off our head, you know, wholesale prices, how many SKUs they have, they last changed their packaging, you know, everything like this. We need to know it as if we had created this brand.
Yeah.
So yeah, so I think that there's a lot to be said about the retail route, the bricks and mortar route, and distribution. I do think it gives you the, I used to call them like safe houses.
I mean, do you
Like,
think that? Sorry, carry on.
no, I was just going to say that I always look at, if you look at some of the big retailers around the world, and I would always consider them safe houses because they do have your back. They really do. And I think that they're, in the long term, they want you to succeed as much as you want to succeed. And you just have to, it has to be a give and take relationship, like
Yeah.
anything.
Yeah. So you're like working together. You're not at cross purposes where the retailer's like, right, well, let's see how much you can sell. And then, you know, we'll see if you can keep your shelf space here kind of thing.
Yeah, exactly. You know, before you get to that, you know, it's like, what can we do marketing wise? What can we do? Is what can, you know, where can we help? What can we do? You know, and all of these conversations happen once you know, like you said, Space NK, you're like, oh my God, I go into Space NK. It's great. Well, you need to do, you can't just sit on the shelf. You also need to
Yeah.
do stuff to stay there.
Do you think a lot of brands are can be quite naive where that's concerned. They think, well, that they just sort of hand the reins over to you and be like, right, well, get us into Space NK. And then they sort of see it as kind of, well, I've passed the baton now, so we can just get on with other things.
I think it's really difficult for brand founders. One, it takes time to build trust with me and the Filthy team because they don't know us. Obviously, the longer that we have been in business, our CV then starts to speak for itself, which is huge help for us. Two, I think that there's a also at Filthy, there's a quite a lot of, like, not in a bad way, but there's a lot of like education that goes into understanding how retail works. And also managing expectations is huge. And actually, I think that is the hardest part of what we do is managing expectations. So someone could think that going into Selfridges, you'll be making 2 million in sales every year just because you're in Selfridges. And actually, you have to then tell founders, like, this is the forecast they've given you, but to do that, you'll need to be doing, you have to invest in like pop-up space or gift with purchase, like all the other stuff that isn't really spoken about to get to that sellout. And it can be quite brutal to hear it. It isn't just a one-way street. It isn't just like, we've got you into Space NK, and then now it's up to Space NK to sell your product. They've actually opened the doors to you, and now you still have to sell it. And it's, I don't know if it's, I think it's just a different category of selling that people struggle with because it is so much slower. And it is really hard work. Like, it isn't, unless you're already a massive brand, you know, like the scented candle in categories dominated by like Diptyque, Cyr Trudon, you know, those sort of brands. You know, if you're a young brand like August and Pierce, you have to be like, okay, so how am I going to get Selfridges to back me over someone like Diptyque who has millions in the bank? So you have to really think outside of the box.
Definitely.
You know, one of the founders goes down every Saturday and hangs out by the candles selling them. Like, well, I really hope Selfridges aren't listening, but yeah.
Yeah, and I imagine that's where your kind of brand voice comes in, that you have to have that kind of strong, punchy identity and that tone of voice. And like I was saying before, like that brand story in order to sort of differentiate yourself from the likes of Diptyque, or Cyr Trudon, that this is why we're different, because otherwise, why would I, pay a lot of money for your candle when I know that I'm going to get a decent throw and a decent scent with Diptyque, and rather than take a risk on a brand that I don't know.
Yeah, exactly. You know, and it's the same with fragrance. I mean, fragrance is a little more, I think the consumer in fragrance is a little more explorative than the candle world. And people do go to the Liberty fragrance room and go there to really discover new fragrances. It's all about education, I feel. And you know, some of the shop floor staff have been there for decades. I mean, Stuart, I don't know how long he's been there for, but he's been there for years. And you just,
Fragrance Hall's incredible.
pardon?
I said the Liberty Fragrance Hall is just incredible in of itself.
Yeah, it's beautiful. And you just think about all these, it's all the little things that really count. It's, you know, going to Stuart at Liberty and being like, I really want to tell you about my brand. And not just relying on Filthy because, you know, obviously we can go in and be like, right, so this is everything, but I'm not the brand founder. So the work as the founder is also just to continue being a part of it. And I think that's where the teamwork comes in. Leave me to talk to, you know, the buyers and the distributors. That's fine. I'm the one with the relationship with them. But when it comes to your brand story, why did you create it? Why do you believe in it so much? And why do you think it should be as big as, I don't know, Frédéric Malle or Francis Coujustin? You know, why? That will be down to you to tell that story.
For sure. What's been your kind of biggest success stories and like the brands that you've been the most proud of? Because I know you mentioned that you love working with startups and seeing them like go to market and everything sort of come to fruition. So what you're sort of like, what things sort of stand out for you?
I mean, I guess the first one would be Fugazi on Cult Beauty. I think the whole Fugazi story is definitely something I'm really, really proud of. It also gave me a boost of confidence, not in a, like, I had just started Filthy by myself, and I think I was anxious, to say the least.
Can't even imagine like the pressure you must have been under. I mean, I don't know how you coped with it because it's so tough when you're sort of starting out something new.
Yeah, and it was, locked down, and like you can't go and see everyone in the stores, and you're not really sure if anybody will remember who you are. And yeah, so I'd say Fugazi gave me the boost of confidence that I knew what I was doing. There was some method to the madness of how I do sales. I think also there have been a couple of highlights last year. Tyler, the creator, obviously being a big one, getting the nod from someone as influential as him to partner with me globally for Golf Lafleur was huge.
Amazing.
And then Commodity, being now the owner is Vicken, who owns one of the largest distribution fragrance distribution companies in Europe, and asking us to help him in the UK. I think for me, those really stand out as big moments. That are also incredibly humbling, because it's, yeah, I don't know. I think you kind of, you, I, in sales, you never really take a moment to be like, okay, I did it. It's all going okay.
Yeah, you can't rest on your laurels.
No, you can't. You're always like, okay, next one, next one,
Yeah, I mean, how do you deal with the pressure of it all? Because I imagine there's just so much pressure to get, obviously, brands sort of like assume that you're just going to get them into these stores sort of immediately. So how do you sort of deal with all of that and also managing the relationship with them as well?
Look, I think the pressure is, it gets to all of us. We're a small team. There are five of us in the team, and I think it all gets to us occasionally. I think the main thing is that as long as we know the facts and we know the figures, and we lead with those, and we can look back on those numbers, then that's really reassuring to us. So every Friday, we look at the sales reports from the previous week, and we go, oh, okay, so like that brand needs, we need to really look at this. Why is it not selling? Really looking at the cracks in the business and going, how do we make this, how do we get better sales for X brand or whatever? Yeah, I mean, the pressure is there. I don't know if I handle it very well.
I don't think anyone handles pressure all that well.
I
Sometimes
think
you get to
also
meet
kind of
somebody that
why I
does.
chose sales. Sometimes I wonder, why did I go to PR?
There's a lot of cross. I was going to say there seems to be a lot of crossover because I've interviewed a few PR consultants for this podcast, and from what you're saying, what they're saying, it's a very similar kind of struggle they both have. I think clients kind of expecting that instant gratification, like, well, can you not get me in Vogue? I want to be in Vogue, like, and things like, well, why isn't, you got me in Vogue, why aren't I seeing the sales from it? Imagine there's kind of a lot of similarities between what you do and what PR companies do.
Yeah, definitely. I think there's also the, I mean, from a, I also, not by design, but I do also work with an office full of women. We don't have one man. I mean, it was really not by design. It really is just based on who was best for the job. I think that there's also something really lovely about meeting women in this business. I find that that really helps my stress.
Yeah, I feel like as a whole, we're very supportive of each other and very collaborative as a whole.
I mean, I find, I definitely find, like, when you find someone who's a supporter, you really need to like hang on to them. You need to find your people in this industry. And
100%.
I think that it can be, the fragrance industry is still very heavily dominated by men, so it can be quite intimidating when you're in meetings and you're the only one.
Yeah.
And if you then have no one to talk to about it, so yeah, so if I find a huge amount of comfort in finding my people in this industry that have really helped me grow, and those can be also men as well. I mean, it's not just women. I've got, I've had lots of people in this industry advise me, and they've been super, super helpful.
I mean, the fragrance industry, like you were saying, it feels to me that it's still quite stagnant in terms of being so male dominated. And I wrote an article quite a few years ago now about the sort of new generation of perfumers. And honestly, like every biography, it was like, well, they grew up in France, they spent every weekend at their grandparents in Normandy, and then they went to Grasse. And it was just like, oh my gosh, this is like a parody. But it just, it feels like there is, things are slowly starting to change. Do you see that happening
I
anytime
think,
soon?
yeah, definitely. I mean, there's also I think it also plays into which brands I choose to represent. A 2787 female founder, Versatile Paris female founder, Discotheque fragrances female founders. Crayon, it's a duo, husband and wife duo. There's a real, I think that there is a shift. It's taking time. And it doesn't necessarily play into how I go about choosing which companies we look after, but I think maybe subconsciously it's played into it a little bit. Just if I'm cheerleading smaller niche brands, then within that, I can also champion female-founded brands.
It's exactly what we do at Smart Beauty as well. We kind of focus on the niche kind of female-founded lines, just because, yeah, I just find them interesting to work with. I mean, there are plenty of male-founded lines that are also really cool, but yeah, like you said, there's something about that kind of female founder story that I find a lot of people are drawn to.
There's also, like we work with Maya Ndiaye, who is a
Love
fantastic,
her.
oh God, amazing. I cannot, I mean, just a wonderful perfumer. And she's been running her business, with her small team for, almost a decade. And we partnered with her last year. And there's such a, so I, if I could replicate that relationship over and over again through different brands, I really would. Sorry. It's such a partnership in the way that we discuss things and we think about it, and there's a, I feel moving forward that we've had a few years of like crazy over the top fragrance brands. It's all about catching the eye.
Yeah, being provocative and outlandish and OTT.
There's a part of me which is feeling in my gut that we're moving over to like quiet luxury.
No more vagina candles, you mean?
I wasn't going to say that, but yeah,
First
vagina.
thing that sprung to mind whenever we were talking about that, I was like, yeah.
Yeah, I feel like we're maybe moving into a more peaceful, calm, but I also could be very wrong.
Yeah, I think the rise of kind of spiritual wellness as well. There's a lot of kind of that happening in fragrance, would you say?
I mean, wasn't it Vireo who started the whole?
Yeah, and the whole astrology inspired and Reiki and a lot of these things are now kind of moving over into fragrance, it seems to me.
Yeah, I've had a few meetings with brands, fragrance brands that are now talking about, how a fragrance makes you feel rather than how it makes you smell. I find it interesting. It's d slightly different. I don't know if there are enough people who buy into it, but always open to giving it a try.
Yeah, I guess with the kind of conversations around mental health and people are kind of looking for ways to feel better and reduce their stress levels and just, feel good about life. I
I
guess.
think that it's also just making sure it's not just a marketing ploy. I think that's a
100%.
really big thing, is that use it just as a way to be like, oh, this one will make you go to sleep, or this one will make you feel happy, or
Yeah.
I really would like to see the science behind it before taking it to market.
Definitely. Definitely. I think a lot of people do kind of jump on the bandwagon. It's kind of like with the sustainability conversation, isn't it? I mean, it's
Yeah.
about discerning who's actually walking the walk and who's just sort of, paying lip service and just using buzzwords. But do you see any other kind of interesting kind of challenges with the fragrance industry as it is at the moment for new brands kind of launching, like new perfume brands?
It's really saturated.
Yeah.
It's an overly saturated market. Also, niche fragrance has grown, I mean, faster than any other category in the last couple of years. So, I mean, there's a part of me which feels like it's not going to slow down, but I wonder, I do get a bit nervous about the longevity of these brands because there are so many.
Yeah.
And how do you create a brand that will have huge amount of success in the first 5 years? And then on the bad days, how do they get through that? Or years even, a few bad years. And how do you create a brand that's been so long standing that, that it doesn't just disappear or fold? And I'd like to see what some of these, I mean, I can't fast forward time, but it'd be interesting to see where some of these brands are in 10, 20 years' time.
I mean, the word community gets has been used to death, and I hate talking about, oh, it's about building a community, but there is kind of some truth to that, it's like what Glossier did, for example. And I know they're not just fragrance, but the way they kind of, grew this sort of online presence and people kind of bought into a whole lifestyle, not just the products. Do you think that's a kind of good avenue to start with?
Yeah, but it's also how do you like you say, like you have to, if you start with fragrance, let's say, then I guess the next natural step would be to step into home fragrance. Then you could do the beauty route. How do you build a one-stop shop for your community?
Yeah.
That is really, for me, that seems to be the only really way forward. I don't think you can rely on the loyal customer for 20 years anymore. Like we go back to that beginning of that conversation about, your own scent. You're not going to have your own scent now for 40 years. You're going
No.
to. So how do you keep your customer coming back? And I don't know if the community is there, but I don't know how loyal people are anymore.
No, but in a way that's good that they're not going to just stick with their, trusty Chanel number 5, but they are going to branch out and try different scents. I guess that in a way that is kind of promising news for sort of startup brands that are.
It's super promising, and I think it's a great way to it opens up. It's almost like now there's like loyalty, customer loyalty to fragrance notes rather than brands. So maybe actually what these young brands need to focus on is, like you say, the community. Why come back to DS and Derga, for instance? Why go back to the Labo? Why go back to Fugazi or Crayon or any of these brands? What is the pull? What are Le Labo doing to get their customer returning every year to buy new fragrance that these young brands in their infancy should be looking at? And maybe that is what they need to be looking at is, what are these brands doing now that we can start implementing from day zero?
Yeah, no, that makes a lot of sense. We're almost at the end of our time, but I wanted to ask you, like, where you see the future of Filthy Brands and what would be, your ideal sort of scenario, say like 5 years from now, just even with, not just yourselves, but kind of the industry in general, where would you like to see things going?
Oh, it's you're, I think you're the second person to have asked me in about 2 weeks, where do I see Filthy in 5 years? I've actually never really thought about it. I've
Yeah.
only been in survival mode.
Yeah, I'm really into manifesting at the moment, so I'm just kind of like, where's my, what's
Okay.
my plan?
Right. Let's manifest.
Yeah.
I think everybody always asks if we would ever do our own brand, and I would definitely say no. I'm not, I don't want to do a filthy brand. I think for us, it would be about creating an accelerator program. It sounds really boring. but actually, what I would like to be able to do is create a branch of Filthy, which is a real joint partnership. And so, where brands who, you know, a lot of these brands need investment, they need injections of cash to help with product design, marketing, and I'd love to be able to offer that. So having, I think ideally in the next 5 years, I'd like to create, you know, a Filthy fund for
Great
brands.
name.
I'm putting it out there, Viola.
Yeah.
A Filthy fund. So if, for example, a brand was like, I'd love to redesign my packaging. I've had the same packaging for 10 years, and we need to do something a bit different. Then I can say, oh, okay, great. Well, here's our Filthy fund,
Yeah.
and offer it to them that way. And I think that would be super interesting.
We definitely need more women in the sort of VC space, because as I'm sure you know, the stats are so depressing when it comes to the amount of female founders that get investment.
What is it, 3%?
Something like that. Yeah. And I think it's the people that are sort of deciding who to give the money to are mainly men. So, you know, to put it bluntly. So I think having more kind of female founded programs like what you were mentioning, I think is super important for the next generation of kind of female founded brands to actually have a shot.
I think, yeah, I think, you know, if there was a space where like I could make that happen, I mean, I don't think it's that far-fetched. I think that, you know, if, okay, yeah, fine, I'm going up against, you know, accelerator programs at, you know, all of the big guys. And, you know, I'm not going to be Manzanita anytime soon. But it would be nice to put that out there and have something smaller, which is much more accessible.
Yeah.
And obviously, I understand that for investment, you need to be able to see traction and all of that. But there are brands that you can find that within the first couple of years, or, you know, and I think that if they worked with Filthy for 2 years, and then why can't they have access to that fund? Because we have already partnered with them, and then it's just the next.
Yeah, and you know that brand inside out by that point, so you don't really need them to sell it into you why that, you
No,
know,
exactly.
you should work with them.
So yeah, so and I think that one of the one thing that I hear over and over again is just how much these young brands need some cash. I'm like,
Yeah,
okay,
cash is king.
cash is king, so let's go find you some money.
Yeah, well, on that note, it was. Thank you so much, Francesca, for speaking with me. I really appreciate it. And looking forward to hearing what you guys sort of get up to over the next few years. I really hope that that accelerator program idea, I'd like to see more programs like that in the near future, especially with beauty in the beauty industry.
Let's make it happen.
I hope you enjoyed that episode. All links will be in the show notes, and feel free to visit smartbeautycreative.com or visit us over on Instagram to find out more about what we do. And if you enjoyed listening, please don't forget to rate and review Smart Beauty on iTunes, as it helps people find us. See you next time.